Good morning. This is AM. I'm Tony Eastley. Expressing horror at the latest massacre in Syria, Special UN and Arab League envoy Kofi Annan says it's time to step up the pressure on President Bashar al-Assad unless he calls a halt to the violence. Mr. Annan and UN leader Ban Ki-moon both condemned the reported slaughter of dozens of people in the village of Al-Kubair. But at this stage, without the support of influential nations like China and Russia, it's hard to know what else the UN can do but express its outrage. Adding to the United Nations problems, it's been told its observers were shot at while on their way to the scene of the massacre. From our North America Bureau, here's Brendan Trembath.
Minutes before the United Nations chief was due to speak at UN headquarters in New York, he received more bad news from Syria. A UN team attempting to investigate a reported massacre was in grave danger.
The UN monitors were shot at with small arms.
Ban Ki-moon has called UN monitors the eyes and ears of the international community.
I call on President Assad to allow the UN observer mission to do its work safely and without interference or intimidation.
The UN Secretary General says each day brings more atrocities. He's described reports of another massacre as shocking and sickening. Some of the victims were allegedly burned or slashed with knives.
We condemn this unspeakable barbarity and renew our determination to bring those responsible to account.
It's less than 2 weeks since more than 100 people were killed in a massacre in the village of Hula.
Any regime or leader that tolerates such killing of innocent has lost its fundamental humanity.
But Syrian officials have rejected reports of a new massacre. State television has reported that security forces attacked an armed terrorist stronghold in the village of Kubair after appeals from locals. Diplomatic efforts to end the violence in Syria are having little impact. But the international envoy, Kofi Annan, is not giving up.
If things do not change, the future is likely to be one of brutal repression, massacres, sectarian violence, and even all-out civil war. All Syrians will lose.
Many diplomats agree. Australia's UN ambassador is Gary Quinlan.
We urge all parties to the crisis to adhere to the terms of the ceasefire and end the violence immediately.
And he's concerned about the safety of UN monitors.
The observers are doing difficult, dangerous, but of course vital work, and the Syrian government must meet its obligation to protect these personnel as well as to guarantee their unrestricted access. Australia has joined many states in the Human Rights Council and the General Assembly to send the clear message that violence must stop and that genuine political reform must commence.
But much depends on how more powerful nations view events in Syria. China's UN ambassador is Li Baodong.
There should be no delay to achieve a comprehensive ceasefire and a cessation of violence in Syria.
He says, though, that China opposes any attempt to force out Syria's leader. That's Russia's view, too. The United States wants him out.
And Syria will not, cannot be peaceful, stable, or certainly democratic until Assad goes.
The U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was speaking in Turkey.
The time has come for the international community to unite around a plan for post-Assad Syria.
But she's not suggesting he be removed by force. She still says he must transfer power and leave Syria. This is Brendan Trembath reporting for AM.
Customs is planning to slash staff from 14 offices across the country, according to an internal document obtained by the ABC. The biggest job cuts would be in ports deemed low risk, such as Townsville, Cairns and Thursday Island. Unions and local councils say cutting customs staff in these areas could make it easier for criminals. Dubrovka Voloda reports.
The document obtained by the ABC shows customs is planning to cut 37 jobs in district offices. That's up to a third of jobs in some areas. Another 7 jobs are to be relocated to Brisbane and Fremantle. If the cuts go ahead, Cairns would lose 6 positions. The city's mayor, Bob Manning, isn't impressed.
I realise that risk management is a prime consideration, but you'd have to wonder about that being the case in Northern Australia, where we act as a major entry point, where we have great lengths of coastline, which are not subjected to patrol. So the opportunity for people to enter Australia illegally is quite pronounced. It would seem to be contradictory to anecdotal evidence.
And the union, which represents customs officers, has also slammed the decision. CPSU spokeswoman Nadine Flood.
You're looking at a cut of 24% of customs staff in district offices. These are staff who do critical work at our ports, ensuring that they're checking cargo on the docks, they're performing surveillance, and they're searching for illegal items such as guns and drugs. Cuts of this magnitude have got to have an impact on customs operational capacity.
She says low risk doesn't mean no risk.
Well, despite customs management assurances that they're making cuts in ports with less high-risk activity, staff are deeply concerned that there will be an impact on their operations.
But the Customs and Border Protection Service says the plan will have little impact on their operations. Spokesman Matt Wardell says large ports are simply at greater risk than small regional ports.
Like any agency, we have to live within our budget. We certainly intend to work with our staff and with the union to determine the most effective and efficient way to achieve some of those savings. Wherever possible, we expect to be able to achieve these savings from non-frontline areas. So it's certainly not the case that in these areas there will no longer be customs officers boarding ships or out at the port.
Customs is currently consulting with its staff.
Dubrovka Voloda reporting. Questions remain about whether alleged people smuggling kingpin Captain Emad will have his refugee protection visa revoked by the government. But at the moment, it is a moot point. Captain Emad was allowed to leave Australia this week after he was exposed by the ABC's Four Corners program. The Australian Federal Police say they had him and others in his syndicate under surveillance, but didn't have enough evidence to charge him. A lawyer who's defended those involved in the people smuggling trade says it is difficult for police to mount cases against smugglers. Michael Vincent reports.
Less than 24 hours after Four Corners went to air, Captain Emad fled the country with the full knowledge of Australian authorities. AFP Commissioner Tony Negus.
What some people will talk to Four Corners about and present about and what they will come to a court and give evidence about may be two different things. And we're faced with dealing with that sort of thing every day in this environment.
Peter Russo is a lawyer in Brisbane whose practice has defended Indonesian boat crew members and at least one people smuggling organiser.
Basically, they have to prove beyond reasonable doubt that the person does exactly that, organises or facilitates. Collecting money, making passenger lists, you know, organising a bus, for example, to drive them to the port, etc.
He says in most cases the evidence is based on eyewitness testimony of boat passengers, and the cases highlighted by Four Corners wouldn't be easy to prosecute now because so much time has passed.
The thing that sort of concerned me about it, just purely from an evidentiary position, was that it's something that they're talking about that has occurred quite some time ago. And their recollection of it and how much of what they're saying can be actually proved in fact.
What about the allegations in the program that he was still actively being sought out for advice on people smuggling, if not involved directly in organising new boats?
I couldn't see the full pieces of the puzzle being able to actually give enough for the authorities to arrest him.
Given that federal police have said they were looking at these people for 2 years, do you have any sympathy for their inability to arrest or stop Captain Emad from leaving Australia?
Oh, look, you know, policing is a very complex issue, so there could be a number of reasons why he was allowed to leave. It could be that it suits their purposes for the furtherance of the investigation. It could be just simply, as the AFP have stated, that they simply did not have enough evidence to act on, and therefore the AFP have acted in a responsible manner. I mean, I don't think that we could say that the investigation into him has ceased. If anything, it's probably, I'd hazard a guess and say that it would have been stepped up a notch.
But he's left the country.
But the AFP have stated that they have a really close and good working relationship with our neighbours. I think that's code for watch this space.
The Immigration Minister, Chris Bowen, has said in a statement that he's waiting for his department to report back to him on whether there are grounds to cancel Captain Emad's refugee status.
Michael Vincent, our reporter. You're listening to AM around Australia, where it's 20 minutes past 7. The Foreign Minister, Bob Carr, has warned that sanctions could be reimposed on Burma if the country's military-backed government falters in its reform process. Senator Carr has announced on a trip to Burma that Australia's remaining sanctions on the country will be lifted. He says it's time for engagement with Burma to foster reform rather than coercion. In Burma's capital, Rangoon, Bob Carr spoke to our Southeast Asia correspondent, Zoe Daniel.
Senator, you've decided to relax the last of the sanctions on Burma. Why now?
Well, one of the interesting things was that talking to people in opposition here and people in civil society organisations, there's no passion for the sanctions. They weren't begging Australia to maintain the sanctions. They didn't raise the sanctions. And when I, in a few conversations, said, look, we're moving to where we're going to have to lift sanctions, they were very relaxed about it, even in one case from a victim of the previous regime who'd been in jail for 22 years. With a Buddhist serenity, he said, well, words to the effect, we've got to start solving our own problems now. And I thought Aung San Suu Kyi said it well when she put to me, we've got to change as a result of our own dynamics, not as a result of, not her words, but coercive pressure from outside.
But she also said it's not time for reckless optimism, it's time for healthy scepticism. And she has viewed the sanctions as a lever of pressure on the government. So is it taking away a tool that you may need later?
More specifically, she defined a position as wanting sanctions suspended, not lifted. And effectively, that's where we are, because with a signature on a piece of paper, we can reinstate the sanctions we had.
So they could be put back?
They could be put back. It would probably take something way beyond the likely to have us put them back. But I found talking, as I said, even to opposition politicians here, there's a desire for the place to be treated like a normal country and a recognition that civil society is now strong enough to continue to provide its own impetus for change.
Except that, you know, a very short time ago there was discussion of prosecuting some of the junta members in the International Criminal Court for human rights abuses, and now sanctions are being lifted, the country is supposedly normalising, but they're still part of the administration. So are we forgetting things that have happened before too soon?
Yeah, to prosecute or not to prosecute is a challenge that faces any society in the transition from a dictatorship, including a military dictatorship, to normal civil society. Now, in South Africa, you saw the truth and reconciliation approach. Members of the apartheid regime were not put in the dock. That enabled society to get beyond it. And there are other patterns where that's been the case as well. There are other models, to be sure. Out of the Balkans, for example, where matters, and out of West Africa, where matters have gravitated towards the international criminal courts. This is a decision that the people of this country have got to make, but they might continue to proceed on the basis that reconciliation and reintegration is the way to go.
Australia's Foreign Minister Bob Carr speaking with Zoe Daniel in Rangoon. The Australian Olympic Committee isn't ruling out dumping controversial swimmers Nick Darcy and Kenrick Monk from the team for London after a photo of them holding guns appeared online. Swimming Australia immediately ordered the removal of the photo from the athletes' Facebook pages and Twitter accounts, and it says an investigation is underway. With more, here's Samantha Donovan.
The photo of the two swimmers shows a smirking Nick Darcy holding two handguns. Kenrick Monk is smiling beside him, holding two bigger weapons crossed in front of his chest. The photo was reportedly taken in a gun shop in California, where some members of the Australian team have been competing. John Crook is the president of Gun Control Australia. He says the photos are sickening and the pair should be dumped from the Olympic team.
They show themselves as about 8 and 9 year olds, showing off with what are some of the most dangerous weapons imaginable.
Nick Darcy was dropped from the Beijing Olympic team after being charged with assaulting swimmer Simon Cowley in a 2008 brawl. He got a 14-month suspended jail sentence for the attack, and he later had himself declared bankrupt to avoid paying Cowley nearly $400,000 in damages. Kenrick Monk was in trouble last year. He was forced to admit he'd lied to police about breaking his elbow in a hit-and-run car accident. He He tearfully confessed to the media he'd fallen while skateboarding. Nick Green is the chef de mission of Australia's London Olympic team. He says he's bitterly disappointed by the posting of the photos.
Particularly these two athletes who have attracted a lot of attention on themselves. You would think there'd be a little bit more caution on the way they use their social media, and there'll be a timely reminder when they come back in from the US that you need to monitor the way you use social media and do it wisely.
Do you think the two of them should be allowed to swim in London?
It's a question that will get asked a lot around these two particular swimmers. Has this notion brought them into disrepute in the eyes of the agreement that they sign? Clearly what it has done is has breached a social media guideline that we think is important.
So what is the process now? Will Swimming Australia and the Australian Olympic Committee be giving any consideration to dumping them from the team?
Well, ultimately that decision is made by the Australian Olympic Committee, which is me and a committee who includes our members into the team. We will look at all facts that are presented to us about is there any athlete that have breached the team agreement? And one of those breaches, have they brought themselves into disrepute and therefore bring the Australian Olympic Committee into disrepute? We will wait to see what Swimming Australia do. Haven't met the athletes. They're on a plane at the moment. We will consider whether it's enough for us to take further action on the swimmers.
Swimming Australia says it'll be speaking to Nick Darcy and Kenrick Monk when they arrive back in Australia today.
Samantha Donovan. Australian choristers love to sing and in some cases compete, and soon a small group of choristers from Bendigo will get a chance to pit their vocal cores against some of the best in the world. Cincinnati in the US is about to host the World Choir Games, something akin to the Olympics, and the Australians would like to think they've got a chance of getting a medal. Stephanie Corsetti reports.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the 3-minute call.
3 minutes.
Just a reminder, 3 minutes.
It's almost showtime for the Bendigo Youth Choir. Backstage, singer Michelle Bloom is busy with final preparations.
We actually start in San Francisco. I think we have 3 days in San Francisco. We have just a few concerts there, but they're not actually competition. Then we go to Cincinnati where the competition is, so it'll be all hard slog then. And then we actually go to LA and get to go to Disneyland.
Fellow singer Christina Murray says the group has a good chance of earning a place in the top 20.
It's been a lot of hard work and we've gotten a few, you know, sour looks from conductors at times, but it's all been worth it and we know that she's pushing us to be our best.
There are five other Australian choirs competing in the Games, including the Young Adelaide Singers and the University of Newcastle Chamber Choir. But tour manager Mandy Cooper says the Bendigo Singers have the advantage of strong community support.
$270,000 is the cost of this tour. It's very daunting, but we do the best that we can. We fundraise and we seek support from the community. We've been fortunate to get Bendigo Wealth as a corporate, major corporate sponsor behind us too. So we've made some inroads, but everyone just works really, really hard selling chocolates and raffle tickets and turning sausages at barbecues.
And the 30 choristers have another secret vocal weapon, harmonic overtone singing.
That's where they use their voices to effectively create almost two voices. And the best way I can describe it is it sounds like a didgeridoo. Some of them sound like bells, and the combination of those noises or those voices is just quite remarkable. I'm not sure if there are actually any other choirs in Australia who have perfected that, so that's something that they showcase and does make them stand out as being very special.
Do you think it'll be tough, though? You're competing against a lot of big choirs from colleges and
absolutely
all over the world.
And it's interesting, how do you compare the voice of our choir compared to that of another that might have more mature voices or male voices? I know that the choir will step up and just give the best performance that they can give.
Group's repertoire includes songs performed in Russian, Latin and Samoan. The choir flies out of Australia at the end of the month to compete in the six-day sing-off.
Stephanie Corsetti in Bendigo reporting. To finance, and global stocks have closed higher after China cut its official interest rate for the first time since 2008. A quarter of a percentage point cut to 3.25% is a sign of China's concern about the Eurozone crisis and what it might do to the Chinese economy. The surprise announcement, on top of yesterday's stronger-than-expected employment figures, took the Aussie dollar briefly back above parity. A short time ago, it had fallen to just under 99 US cents. In New York, the Dow Jones has closed up 46 points, the NASDAQ down 14. In London, the FTSE finished up 64. I'm Tony Eastley, and that's AM for today.